I'm Christopher Lydon in Cairo with Heba Morayef, who runs the Human Rights Watch desk here in Egypt. Born in Alexandria, of an Egyptian father, an Australian mother, educated in Egypt. I want to know, Heba, first, how you came to be seen so widely among many people I've spoken to as the kind of guardian angel of human decency in this part of the world. How did it happen?
I think that's very kind of the people you spoke to. I mean, I'd been working in human rights, in any case, ever since I left university, really. And I think I was in an age group that was sort of in the right place at the right time when the January uprising happened in 2011. And all of a sudden, human rights defenders who'd been doing the same work for years and years really had something to say, and there was an international media that was interested in listening and really listening. They'd been working on torture, on, you know, police abuse, on violence against demonstrators for years and years and years under Mubarak, and all of a sudden it really mattered. It was part of the political moment. Also on social justice issues, obviously, because that was another, you know, another one of the main demands of the uprising. And I think the status of human rights defenders of the human rights community in Egypt also shifted after the uprising, both in terms of domestic politics, because all of a sudden the Egyptian media was no longer scared to cover torture cases, was no longer scared to take pictures of police officers beating up women protesters, and to actually publicize the things that we were working on. And that's really what you need as a human rights defender. You need that exposure.
What did the Iraq war have to do with it? What was the context in the culture, would you say?
I think the Iraq war in 2003 was key, and especially for my generation, because it was the first time since the 70s that protesters for one day actually managed to gather in Tahrir. And it was only around 20 or 25,000. But it was the most exciting moment that my generation had seen, because since 77, there hadn't been any protests in that square. And that was a turning point. And I think we all remember that, those of us who are now in our 30s, as an important moment, because over the following 8 years, protesters would try to make that moment happen again and would fail because of police violence. And it wasn't really until January 2011 that, you know, that you sort of realize the full power of that square, that if you get in there and if there are enough of you, if you manage to take over the square, you can be unstoppable. And I think that was sort of a lesson learned.
Heba Morayef, women in Tunisia had told us before we got here, and women here have reminded us, that Cairo can be a very, very annoying, sometimes upsetting, really upsetting place for women in an atmosphere of harassment. It's unending, they feel, in Cairo specifically. Having said that, I've never felt safer in my life. I've never felt a more relaxed, basically peaceful context. Explain at least the surface tranquility that you feel on the crowded, dense, rather dirty, polluted streets of Cairo.
Tranquility is a subjective experience.
Yeah.
You're a man.
Yep.
Women experience the streets of Cairo differently. Now, I've got used to the streets of Cairo. I've lived here for 14 years, and I've got used to the fact that every time I go out onto the streets, I will get catcalls. I've got used to being very aware of how I walk and who comes near to me, because I've been grabbed and groped before. And I've got used to being very careful, especially in the last 2 years, in bigger crowds and trying to judge the temperature of a crowd before diving in. So you get used to taking care of yourself as a woman, and you can live with it. And I'm happy in Cairo. I love Cairo, and I love the streets, and I love downtown Cairo. There are women who experience that differently, and they see it as a fundamental violation of their private, you know, their personal space and their right to walk down a street unviolated. And they react to the city and to the people, and especially to the men. And I've heard friends, very often non-Egyptians, I think, who are used to what a normal street can look like in a country where women don't experience that kind of violence on a day-to-day basis. And they reject that, and they see Cairo as a fundamentally aggressive city. And I don't see it in that way, but I've also seen how the kind of daily harassment that I've got used to and I consider normal, I've seen how that can escalate into extremely terrifying, violent situations. And in particular over the last 2 years, because we've seen time and time again when it's something to do with the nature of a crowd in Tahrir and the nature of the sit-ins, but there've been multiple instances of mobbing of women, of sexual assault of women. And this last week, human rights organizations have documented 2 gang rape cases, and even yesterday, yet another of these cases of mobbing. So the streets can bring you both experiences, but I think, you know, I think part of the problem within Egyptian society is that the kind of sort of low-level harassment is seen as normal, and neither the government nor the society is trying to do something about it. And the reason I resent that, even though I've become used to it, is that I've seen how it can escalate into really aggressive crime against women, which will fundamentally change, you know, those women's experiences of Cairo. Harassment is not limited to Cairo, you know, even in Alexandria, in downtown Cairo, it's the same problem. So this is a problem that Egypt has to deal with.
Take your reading just a little further. In this rather ambiguous tranquility in the faces, the men's faces I see in Egypt, I can also read 2 things. There's a melancholy and a loss. At the same time, there's a terrific excitement in this post-revolutionary, maybe still pre-revolutionary moment. But I read a kind of double mood of loss and defeat. The week of Gaza shelling made it worse. And yet the revolutionary experience lifts spirits too. Aren't we looking at a kind of two-sided mood and maybe temperament?
I think one of the fantastic things about Cairo is the fact that tragedy can coexist with joy, despair with, you know, energy and enthusiasm. And if you look at the city, if you look, you know, there are neighborhoods where there are slums living side by side by sort of very middle class areas, and where crime and violence can also produce a sort of sense of courage against the state that we saw mobilized politically in an extremely effective and brave way during the uprising. I'm not trying to talk in cliches, but I think nobody can essentialize Cairo at all. And there are these multiple layers, and I think nobody can define Cairo either. And I'm talking about Cairo because obviously it's the biggest city in Egypt, but it's also been at the heart of a lot of the political mobilization over the last 2 years. The uprising in January was not just a political one. It was one where entire generations in Egypt feel such despair about the economic options that lie ahead of them, and such anger at the fact that there's been a failure to provide for social justice, while the clear signs of wealth and corruption in a very small political elite, which was basically, you know, surrounding the Mubarak family, that was one of the sources of rage. That, together with Mubarak's police force, which was abusive not only in political cases, but at a very, you know, at a very grassroots level, your average police officer in your average neighborhood police station would beat up people from the neighborhood to solve an average theft crime. And I think it's that's what brought the rage about and the energy. And at this point, you know, almost 2 years on, I think people are tired. People are tired, but they also changed in January 2011. So while on the one hand, you know, we've all been through highs and lows of high expectations that lasted for a few months, and then followed by despair as we had a year and a half of military rule and saw so much violence, so much abuse, and then, you know, the elections and the aftermath. It's been a very tumultuous year where people's expectations and emotions and feelings towards the country and the city have changed. And so today, I think you see a mix of all of those things. You see this last few days in particular, a new determination or a newfound determination, that energy from January 2011 that's still there, and an excitement to discover that it's still there and it can still be mobilized. But at the same time, looking ahead politically, no easy routes out. And I'm not sure that anybody is going to win this. And we all know it's going to take time, but I think people are also very worried about the future, and I think that's why you may be picking up all these different emotions.
One more crack at that difference of emotions. Looking at these friendly faces in Tahrir Square, elsewhere in Cairo, and the people who say, welcome to Egypt, and are you American, and despite policy, they reach out humanly, I say to myself, where do the torturers come from in Egypt? Where do the bad guys, the thugs, the brutality, where does that come from, and what am I missing?
I don't understand it. I don't understand it because, for me, Egyptians are funny people. They crack the best jokes in the region. Tunisians and Libyans are just not funny compared to Egyptians. Egyptians are very kind people. They're very forgiving. And I don't understand. I'm not a sociologist or a psychologist. I don't understand what makes it so easy for people to then engage in that kind of sustained violence against other people. I don't understand it as a human rights person. I can see how the higher levels within Mubarak's police force, how the generals who were making a lot of money were very corrupt and wanted to maintain a tight grip on the system, and how torture and abuse was one of the tools that they could use. But I don't understand how that can filter down to so many people in the lower ranks of the police. And if you look at the riot police, I mean, so many of them they're all conscripts anyway. I mean, they're young and untrained, and they, you know, I can understand that they are afraid when they're told to go in and police a demonstration, and when demonstrators start throwing stones. But again, what I don't understand is the extreme aggression with which they beat people up when they arrest them. And, you know, even when people have been handcuffed. And we saw that not just from the police, also from the military.
But stick with one tiny telltale mark of the police enforcement, and that's the sniping that takes out a man's one eye. I mean, there's lots of instances of this, thousands probably, and it's become iconic in the art of the revolution. How does Human Rights Watch explain that or begin to deal with it?
Ever since January 2011, we've been documenting the use of force by the riot police, the Central Security Forces, primarily, since they're the ones who are usually deployed. And what we saw back then, and what we've seen time and time again in the context of policing protests that become violent, is that the riot police consistently use excessive force. So it's an impossible message to get across to the Ministry of Interior that if a protester is throwing a stone, that doesn't give you a blank check to do whatever you want to him, that you can, you know, shoot him in the eye, that you can fire tear gas at close range or fire straight at the protester, or that you can then arrest them and beat them up. They just consider that they can use all necessary means to you know, fulfill their goals. And back in January, their goal at the time was protecting Mubarak, and they failed. but they didn't learn a lesson. And so we've seen the same illegal use of weapons happen again and again and again, and especially with the eye injuries. So back in January 2011, hundreds of people had eye injuries and lost eyes. And obviously, you know, November 2012 is the first anniversary of the Mohammed Mahmoud protests in 2011. And the reason there were big protests for the anniversary is because 45 protesters were killed and over 100 either lost or had serious injuries in their eyes from that one protest, and yet there'd been no accountability. And this is why you know, last week's protest started, and yet here we are again seeing exactly the same illegal means used by the riot police. Zero attempt to actually use these weapons legally, because you don't have to injure protesters in the eye. You can shoot at the ground before them if absolutely necessary. There are some circumstances where you're allowed to shoot at their legs. You are never allowed to shoot at their eyes. And it's not just an issue of bad training. It's also an issue of the kind of instructions that the riot police are being given. And the only way I can explain it is that at this point, the police are so resentful of their change of status, are so resentful of the fact that some of them have even been put on trial, that they're taking their anger out on protesters. Because they could do this, you know, even if they continue to do this inefficiently, even with their bad training, they could do this with less harm to protesters.
Everybody tells us that domestic abuse, in a fashion, and extreme patriarchy has a connection to everything else and to the public life of Egypt. I'm thinking also of that extraordinary line in Naguib Mahfouz's Cairo trilogy, where the very thoughtful son Kamal imagines himself, he doesn't quite do it, but imagines himself defying his father and saying, "Father, you're the one who made it easy for me to accept oppression through your continual tyranny." Not to mention the keeping girls uneducated, submissive, order in the house, that kind of thing. I have to ask about female circumcision, genital mutilation. I mean, where does that fit into the problem and your agenda?
Female genital mutilation in Egypt, referred to as FGM, is a cultural practice. It's not actually based on Sharia and Islamic law for once. I mean, there are many other practices that are justified in terms of Islamic law that are also very much about the patriarchal nature of Egyptian society. But this one, interestingly, is cultural. If you look at Saudi Arabia, they don't have FGM. So in a sense, that makes it somewhat easier today to fight that battle, in the sense that you don't come up against the wall of, this is Islam, full stop, we will not discuss it. And in particular, with a new Islamist government. But it's been incredibly difficult to work on FGM as an issue. And obviously, you know, it's a discriminatory and violent form, I mean, an extremely aggressive form of violence against girls in Egypt. It's a practice that still takes place in the south of Egypt. Extremely high percentages of young girls are circumcised because fathers see this as a way of preserving their honor as fathers. And I think it's going to take generations to stamp out. But what it takes is obviously the political will. And I'm not sure we're going to see that political will from the new government. Because the government right now, I think, is very much is very happy to allow fathers to make these decisions for the women in their household, and that's the fundamental problem. You know, in the discussions over Egypt's new constitution that have been ongoing for the last 4 months, they couldn't even agree on including a provision on equality between men and women. And that provision ultimately was withdrawn because the Salafis on the Constituent Assembly wanted that provision to say the state shall provide for equality between men and women insofar as it does not conflict with the rulings of Sharia. And the rulings of Islamic law provide very clear discriminatory provisions on inheritance, on divorce, on rights of custody of children. And that's very set in stone. And that language actually would have been detrimental to women's rights as it is. So within that context, you know, you're fighting this battle on many, many different levels. FGM is one of the more serious abuses that happen to girls. Early marriage is another concern. Also widespread outside the bigger cities in Egypt. that I think is going to be a difficult battle. That and obviously the what women suffer from as a result of discriminatory laws in terms of their right to divorce. I mean, many women are stuck in marriages where they can't get a court to actually allow the woman to initiate a divorce. And obviously the greater problem of violence against women, there's been zero recognition of the issue of domestic violence. And this is a problem globally, but in Egypt it's particularly bad because, again, Islamist government, the Islamist government and parliamentarians, when we had a parliament, refused to recognize the fact that if a husband beats his wife, that that's a violation, because they will justify that also in terms of archaic regulations under Islamic law. And these are uphill battles, but we've seen how some battles slowly and cumulatively over the years, you can eventually have an impact on policy and eventually change things. And, you know, I'm not terribly optimistic in the short term, honestly, and neither about women's rights in general, and in particular about FGM. But I think there are enough outraged women's rights groups and women's rights activists and even some of the more liberal political parties who care about this and who will continue to push on it moving forward. And then we work with them.
Heba, you're thoroughly Egyptian yourself, but where else in Egyptian society do you draw on conscience, on strength, on political muscle? Who are your homegrown allies in human rights work?
I mean, I always say that I'm a member of the Egyptian human rights community, and I mean that because we're a small community, but a good one. And so there are lots of different NGOs who work on violence against protesters, and we each do sort of different bits of the documentation. We share information, we'll monitor protests together, we'll follow up on the cases of people who've been arrested and beaten up. And we often, you know, do our lobbying work together, our advocacy work together, and our media work together. So they're the essential partners, I think, in all of the work that I do. But beyond that, you know, we primarily rely on the Egyptian media, and not just the Egyptian media, but of course social media as well. And there you need to have activists on your side. And I think, again, over the last couple of years, a relationship has grown between the human rights community and the Egyptian media that's been a very productive one in exposing abuse, because the media has been less afraid. So they've been good partners also for the human rights community. And then, you know, there are always certain politicians who are interested in upholding human rights issues and in raising these human rights issues. And in particular, when there was a parliament, we'd try to target those individuals to get them to push forward good legislation. So it's always a discovery process about trying to reach decision makers and trying to influence them.
Heba Mariah, you've been at it for a dozen years or so. Since the late 90s, stand way back and look at the trend line. What's the overall direction of things? What are we going through together?
Well, I know what I'm going through. I know where I'm heading, and that's that I'm doing exactly what I want to be doing. And in a sense, human rights work, we don't really care who's in power, whether it's an Islamist or somebody who's secular. We still want both of them to respect the human rights standards that we work on equally. And, you know, the political context matters. But so you want to have checks and balances. You ideally want a system that will protect the law and that will enable you to operate in. But human rights work will become no less important, I think, in Egypt in the next few decades. It will never become unimportant. So there will always, unfortunately, be more human rights work to be done, more violations to work on. And because that's the kind of work that I like focusing on corners, on specific issues, and trying to fix them. So even if I can fix one little corner, for me that's personally more satisfying than just thinking in terms of I want a revolution to happen right now. Because you have to think, you have to have low expectations, you have to realize that it's a long-term battle. And I think that makes it a lot easier to just emotionally deal with everything that's happening in Egypt, even though I've had my own highs and lows. So personally, I know that I'm going to keep doing what I'm doing, and Egypt is a perfect place to be doing it. Where Egypt is heading is a far more difficult question, especially this week. I think we're in a bit of a stalemate politically, and I'm very worried about the future. I think as long as you can protect institutions, as long as you can protect the overall quality of the transition in terms of legality, then you can keep fighting those battles going forward. But if you have a hijacking of the process or a sort of disabling of one of the core institutions, in this case the judiciary, then the battles become much, much more difficult to fight going forward. And in that respect, I don't really see that American foreign policy is recognizing that. I don't see in the response, and the one response we've had so far from the United States to this latest crisis, a recognition of the fact that you can't support a democratically elected president giving himself a blank check to do anything, even if he argues that it's temporary. That's a fundamentally destructive move and can affect the overall quality of the transition. And, you know, I'm happy that the United States supported a transfer to civilian authority from the military. I was supportive of that myself. But I think the United States should not repeat the same mistakes it made in the time of Mubarak, where it gives unconditional support for geostrategic reasons. And in this case, obviously, the timing of the fact that this came right after the ceasefire, which Morsi negotiated successfully, is particularly reminiscent for us of the kind of statements we'd hear from the U.S. under Mubarak. I know that the U.S. will often do things behind doors, but public messaging is always key, and it's what the leadership here always listens to as well.
And what is the public message that you see getting absorbed on the street? The message from Washington?
Well, the street has a very mixed relationship to the United States. So on the one hand, for most Egyptians, the uprising was also about independence, defining ourselves as Egyptians, as, you know, independent of the United States to a great extent, because Mubarak was seen as somebody, in particular when it comes to the Palestinian conflict, as somebody who followed the United States. And I think that's particularly true because of Egypt's role in the Gaza blockade, and especially during Operation Cast Lead in 2009. So I think for most Egyptians, they want to feel that that Egypt has an independent foreign policy and it doesn't just do the United States' bidding. So sometimes criticism and public criticism from the United States is greeted very negatively by the Egyptian street. You know, people see that as interference. I think at the same time, while you get a lot of Egyptians saying that, you know, they don't want U.S. interference, they don't want to be like the United States, they also always look to the United States in terms of, you know, democratic institutions, or they'll argue, I mean, this is the same as in the U.S. Constitution, or look at in the U.S., they have these, I mean, the U.S. is still frequently a reference. So I think, you know, this is one of the realities of many post-colonial societies, where you reject what you see as foreign imperialist interference, and at the same time you're interested in becoming, at least in terms of some of the institutional aspects, you're also aspiring to some of the institutions that you have in the United States. And I think that's a relationship that the U.S. has to relearn how to manage now that the Muslim Brotherhood are in power, because it's no longer as easy a relationship as it was under Mubarak, where, you know, the lines are clear. And I think it's going to be a complicated relationship. For me, from my perspective, on issues to do with human rights and the transition, the United States is still a key ally for Egypt. And so what it says to the leadership, whether behind closed doors or publicly, will have an impact on progress here. But I think the United States also needs to think in terms of the fact that it needs it needs to think about things like double standards as well in terms of its foreign policy to the region, because that resonates with the Egyptian public, and that will also pressure the Egyptian leadership. So you can't, on the one hand, ignore human rights abuses in the Palestinian territories and yet expect to uphold human rights in Egypt or Tunisia. That's something that will weaken the U.S.'s credibility in the region and its ability to influence.
Heba Mariah, if anybody's doing the work of the Lord, it's you, and you're keeping your head too. Thank you so much for your work and for speaking with Open Source.
Thank you very much for this conversation.